she said, and for a moment he thought she had inferred from a grimace, a sharp intake of breath, the uproar in his belly. Had he groaned or, God forbid, farted without realizing it? "Did your house burn down?"
"I'm fine," he said. "I had turned it off."
"I see." Her tone was distinctly disbelieving. This irked my grandfather for a moment until he recalled that, in fact, he was lying to Sally. She was an observant person, a noticer. There was no human quality that my grandfather held in higher regard. "Well," she said, "that's too bad."
"It's too bad."
"Yes. A little fire might help with the cold feet." This remark puzzled my grandfather. His feet were fine, but then he understood. Sally had no idea that his dinner had given him a cramp. She supposed he was just running away from her, that he was afraid of having, as he put it to me, feelings in that direction. Once he understood, he was shocked. It came as a worse shock to discover, on searching the feelings he was afraid of having, that Sally's supposition was correct. There had been nothing wrong with his stone crab chowder apart from too much salt. The cramp was a case of nerves, not food poisoning.
"Okay, okay," he said, glaring back at the haunted recliner. "I'll be right over."
The unit did not belong to Sally, but to an old friend who was living now with a daughter in Tel Aviv. The friend and her late husband had bought the unit, remodeled it, and furnished it with lots of raffia and glass. And then a week after they moved in, the husband had keeled over on the Fontana Village tennis courts and died. Everything that was not raffia or glass had been painted, covered, or tiled in soft tones of rose and ash gray, a modish palette that Sally didn't care for. A bedsheet had been tacked to the large white wall by the patio doors, where it struck a discordant note, because it was patterned with green and gold dandelions, and because it was a bedsheet.
"You have one of your paintings under there?"
Sally shook her head. She turned to the bedsheet on the wall and lifted it with both hands. My grandfather went and stood underneath this impromptu canopy to look. It was a large photographic portrait in black and white, mounted and matted in a black metal frame. It was a close-up shot of a moon-faced beauty and a handsome fellow with satiric eyebrows, both around his age. They were posed with their heads together, their eyes twinkling with acceptance and wisdom.
"Little did they know," my grandfather said.
She nodded. They stepped out from under the bedsheet, and she let it fall.
"I have to keep it covered," she said. "I don't have the patience for hindsight."
"Too much like regret," my grandfather said. A viable moment had arrived. Sally leaned in to kiss him. He got a late start and then misjudged her angle of approach. There was an unfortunate encounter between her teeth and his chin. She clapped a hand to her mouth, her cheeks ablaze, and made an adjustment to her dental work. My grandfather dabbed at the bite mark on his chin, checked his fingertips for blood.
"Wee wow," he said.
"Shit," Sally said, having restored order in her mouth. "Is this going to be a disaster?" My grandfather had a hunch about it, but he kept it to himself. She reached out and took hold of his chin and examined it, then used her purchase on his chin to guide her mouth toward his. There had been pink grapefruit in her salad at dinner, and he thought he could taste it on her lips. "How about we give it one last try?" Sally said.
"If you wouldn't mind," said my grandfather.
But 13 minutes later, when she emerged from the master bath, having made it plain that she intended to fuck him, the expanse of her naked body, lavishly freckled and presented without modesty, overwhelmed my grandfather. An inner coaxial was cut and his head filled with white noise, and then he passed out. When he came to his senses, he was on his back on the bed in possession of what felt like a monstrous erection. Stretched out alongside him, Sally reached to take hold of it. Before her fingers even brushed against his skin, however, my grandfather came. The spurt was so abrupt and unadvertised that it had the character of a practical joke. Sally flinched and looked slightly offended.
My grandfather's sense of humiliation was acute. It took everything he had not to get up and leave. Pack his car, drive to California without stopping. Only California would not really be far enough.
Sally went back into the bathroom. This time when she came out, she was wearing a robe.
I'm sorry, said my grandfather. Maybe it was a little too soon.
Too soon is better than too late, dear.
Yeah? What if it's too soon and too late?
Oh, it is, Sally said. Definitely. Too soon for that type of talk. She sat down on the bed beside him and gave him a brief, but not perfunctory, kiss on the lips. And too late for backing out now, because I like you.
Sally.
Now was the time at last to talk to her. To tell her about the blood panel and Dr. Mubarak, as my grandfather had come to think of the specialist. Now, before like turned to something stronger, and it really was too late. How do you feel about rum raisin ice cream? Sally said.
I'm the only person I know who likes it.
Not anymore. How about Spencer Tracy?
In my opinion, the best.
I agree. So, Channel 12 is showing Boys Town at 9.
Yeah?
You know, I remember when it came out, it was showing at the Stanley, but somehow I missed it. That's what I'm telling you, Sally said. It's never too late.
Chapter 17. Many years later, when my mother was packing up to move out of the house where my grandfather had died, she came upon some liquor boxes in a crawl space.
It's just a lot of your old junk, she reported when she called me.
Knowing that I had a weakness for old junk in general, but especially my own, she brought the boxes over one afternoon to consign them to the mercy of my nostalgia. The first one I opened was a Captain Morgan rum carton that held 50 or 60 letters and postcards from friends, lovers, and writing teachers of the 1980s. Buried under the old mail were some cassette recordings I had made from a friend's father's collection of Bob and Ray albums, a baggie that held a loose joint, a Hot Wheels Beatnik Bandit, and my brother's vinyl copy of Moving Pictures.
Good box, I said.
In the next one, Gilby's Gin. I found a plastic shopping bag from New Rose Records in Paris. It once held either Fire of Love or a Johnny Thunders live album, depending on which visit to New Rose it was from. Now it contained a floppy black felt hat with a wide brim. That, an unopened box of blank TDK cassettes, and an Aquarian deck of tarot cards bought at Spencer Gifts in the Columbia Mall when I was 13, turned out to be all there was in the Gilby's box. I scowled at the hat, trying to place it.
Blonde,
my mother said, tweezing a long strand from the nap of the wide felt brim. Simultaneously, we recalled having seen this hat on the head of my fair-haired ex-wife. I pointed to the third carton, which once held a dozen bottles of Old Crow. Its cardboard was more brittle than the others, its typography antiquated, its cartoon crow a raffish jazz-age dandy. It had been sealed with old-fashioned packing tape, the kind you use to have to moisten with a sponge.
I'm pretty sure that one's not mine, I said. It looks really old.
Oh, my mother said, slicing through the packing tape with her house key.
Huh.
I thought I caught a note of unease, or at least wariness, in her voice, but that may be a detail contributed by hindsight. The first thing to come out of the box were some children's books, small hardcovers without jackets. The Black Stallion, Misty of Chincoteague and King of the Wind, National Velvet, and one called Come On, Seabiscuit. Beneath these lay a manila folder and a zippered fabric pouch. The folder was full of color photographs of thoroughbreds clipped from magazines, pasted onto cardboard backing, and cut out to make horse paper dolls. The zip pouch held up moldering remains of miniature tack my mother had fashioned for her paper horses out of bits of lanyard and leather thong and scraps of what looked like brown nauga hide.
That's what Velvet did, my mother explained, in the book.
So I made my own. But then your grandpa made these for me. From the old crow box she took 9 little wooden horses, each balled up in a page from the Baltimore Sun for November 12, 1952. As she unwrapped each one, she set it on my kitchen table. The horses stood about 3 inches at the shoulder, carved. The first two with a pocket knife, my mother recalled, the rest with a set of carving tools, from soft, lightweight wood. Each had been fitted with a mane and tail made of brush bristles, then painted. Bay, chestnut, brown, dappled gray, dun, black, white, piebald, midnight blue. The modeling of the brown and the bay was crude, simplified almost to the point of abstraction. But after the first two, my grandfather's skill had improved along with his tools. There was real likeness, if not realism, in the arcs of the other horses' necks, in their streamlined heads and balletic poses. I held up the blue horse. Kind of whimsical for Grandpa. That's Midnight. He knew how to fly. Midnight, I said. Ooh. I flew Midnight in a figure eight over the heads of the other horses and brought him in for a landing. I was surprised to discover at this late date that some part of the business of her girlhood had been conducted in my mother's imagination. When she told a story from those days, it was usually an account of something observed, overheard, endured, or undertaken, as though her formative years had been spent entirely in the world outside her own head. In self-portrait, she was a child without daydreams, without fears, fantasies, doubts, longings, or unaskable questions. When I was a boy, my most routine flights of fancy and invention always seemed to leave her shaking her head, looking up at God or the kitchen ceiling, making a face that said something along the lines of, "Where does he get this shit?" When I heard about Midnight, it made me wonder if she had been sandbagging all this time, pretending to be ignorant of a language in which she was conversant, if not fluent. Concealing her origins, safely assimilated into a daylight country of earthbound horses. "What else you got in there?" I said. She glanced into the old crow box and looked away. She swept up all the blown blossoms of newsprint and shoved them, crinkling down, into the box. "Well," she said, and I understood that there was something else in the box. She turned to the little painted remuda on the kitchen table. Her eyebrows tangled above the bridge of her nose, and her mouth was pursed as though the horses presented her with a problem. At first I thought she might be debating whether or not to make a present of them to my younger daughter, who was then on the cusp of the velvet brown years. But my mother's eyes seemed too far away and fretful for that. "Well," she said again. She folded the flaps of the box and picked it up. "I can leave all that here for the kids if you think they'll want it."
"Great."
"What?"
"No, nothing."
"I know," my mother said. I saw her push herself to say the next word. "Horses."
"A whole box of them."
"You think that's weird because of my mother."
"No, I mean, 1952.
So you were 10 when all this got packed up?" "Yes, I went to live with Bubby and Zeta." These were her names for my grandfather's parents, dead long before I was born. They were over in Camden by then. It was only supposed to be until he found work, but I ended up finishing the school year in Camden. It took him a while to get a job. He ended up in New York.
On Radio Row, right, where the World Trade Center is?
He worked for Arrow as a store manager, and then when Arrow started selling parts to companies, he went into sales, because the money was better. I went to live with him in Queens.
"Where was Grandma?" I said, though I guessed the answer to my question the moment I asked it.
"November 52, my mother said. "That was the first time."
"Ah.
They dropped me with Bubby and Zeta, and then he took her to the hospital. She was really, you know, something was really out of whack."
She was looking at the midnight blue horse. The bristles of its mane and tail were ivory white. Its head was angled skyward as though in aspiration. Any kid could have seen, I thought, that it was the magic one, the one that might be able to fly.
"I mean, all girls have the horse thing around that age," I said. 10, 11, 12, it's super common."
"Mm-hmm,"
my mother said. But it didn't sound like she was agreeing with or even humoring me. She was pitying me. She thought that I was kidding myself, in denial. "Because, I mean, did you know about the skinless horse?" I said, "before she went into the hospital the first time?"
She set the box down on the kitchen table. I started the tea kettle.
I had some drambuie on hand. I assured her that it was not too early in the day to add a slug of the stuff to one's cup of Earl Grey.
Before that, she said, did I know?
Did I know? I mean, I sensed. She paused, reluctant to carry on in this vein, trucking with things that could merely be sensed.
I knew she was afraid of something I couldn't see.
I poured tea from the pot into her mug and doctored it to her specifications.
She took a sip, and then, a moment later, took another, longer sip.
Good, she said.
She didn't say anything else after that, and she probably would have liked to move on.
So when you were 10, I said, November 1952, you packed it all up in that box.
Yep.
It kind of looks like you never unpacked it again.
I never did.
How come?
Because I stopped liking horses.
Because you found out about the skinless horse?
No, my mother said.
She drained the cup of spiked tea.
Then she opened up the flaps of the Old Crow box again and started rooting down through the crumpled flowers of Baltimore to the bottom.
Because I saw it.
My grandmother was an on-air personality, star would be overstating the case, on station WAAM from around 1948 to 1952. In those years, relatively few Baltimore household owned television sets. Growing up in the Baltimore area 20 years later, I rarely encountered people who had seen my grandmother on TV. From time to time, when I was a kid, a former housewife of the 50s might recollect the pert, impeccably coiffed ménagère who calmly disjointed rabbits or whacked cutlets with a tenderizer while wearing pearls in a Dior dress supplied by Hutzler's, the sponsor of La Cuisine. My mother is now my only surviving authority for Channel 13's having aired a French-language instruction program taught by my grandmother on Sunday mornings, after the Christophers. And nobody ever seemed to remember Faye Beau, the French weathermaid, promising sunshine or warning of storm fronts on News at Noon in her black livery and starched white cap and apron. To this day, most of the people who remember my grandmother on television were kids at the time, my mother's age or a little older, and what they remember is a mass of dark hair teased into a feathery cowl around a dead white face, eyebrows like a raven's wings, dark sleeves restlessly flapping and swooping in a dry ice fog as my grandmother stalked the set of The Crypt of Nevermore, an antebellum Gothic fantasia of toppled columns, tilted headstones, and iron gingerbread. They remember her as Nevermore the Night Witch, and they are unanimous in recalling that if you were allowed to stay up late on a Friday night during those years and tuned in to Channel 13 for the 45 minutes before WAAM's 12:45 sign-off, my grandmother would freak you the fuck out. Television's first horror host is generally agreed to have been Myla Nurmi, a.k.a. Vampira, who emerged a couple of years afterward from some murky Hollywood borderland of cheesecake soft porn and Maya Deren-esque surrealism to introduce and heap ridicule upon Z-grade thrillers on KABC in Los Angeles. Others in other cities, Zachary in New York, Goulardi in Cleveland, Marvin in Chicago, emerged toward the end of the decade, after the classic Universal horror films were packaged for television. And though they had their own gimmicks, they all more or less followed the pattern laid down by Vampira. Camp, innuendo, and the airing of movies ripe for mockery by the host of the show. Nevermore the Night Witch wasn't like that. She didn't show movies. There were no horror movies licensed to be shown on television. And if there had been, the brothers who owned the station, more friends of the ubiquitous Judge Waxman, would not have seen the value in acquiring them. She handed up pretty good, my grandfather told me, but she played it straight, not for laughs. The accent helped. She lived in the Usher family crypt, that was the shtick, name over the door. He closed his eyes, and they sank into the purple shadow that surrounded them. He reran the grainy kinescope of memory. She's there. Spatzerizing around the graves, she turns and looks at the camera. Oh, his voice went half an octave up and took on a certain slinkiness. I see you have dared to return, right? Then she invites you in. The camera, what do you call, zooms in on the iron gate of the crypt. Meanwhile, she has to quick run around to the other half of the set where it's supposed to be the inside of the crypt. Cut to the other camera. She comes in, sits down in a chair, more like a throne. I think they got it from a church. She picks up a book and she reads, out loud, ghost stories, weird tales, that type of thing. Never my cup of tea. The Crypt of Nevermore, broadcast live, aired weekly from October 7, 1949, the centennial of Edgar Allan Poe's death, to October 24, 1952. Baltimoreans who sat down at midnight on October 31, 1952, to watch the Night Witch's presentation of Poe's Metzengerstein, as promised by TV listings in The Sun, were surprised to find only a static shot of a jack-o'-lantern posed on a wooden stool in a fog of CO2. The holes of its face had been hacked in haste with some dull tool, and as its candle guttered and flared, the jack-o'-lantern displayed an expression of torment that many viewers, according to a subsequent report in The Sun, found disturbing. There were complaints. On the following Friday at midnight, an old March of Time newsreel was shown. Neither the Crypt of Nevermore nor my grandmother ever returned to the air. Around 5:30 that Halloween Friday, my grandfather was in the kitchen of a rented house on Main Avenue in Forest Park. On first walking in the door that evening, home early for a change, he had wrapped 3 potatoes in foil and stuck them in the oven. Now he had a steak frying in a cast-iron skillet, and a pot on the boil for some wax beans. He stood at the range, sleeves rolled, still in suit pants and necktie, wearing an apron patterned with tomatoes on a background of yellow plaid. Pancake turner in one hand, tumbler of scotch in the other. Every Friday night he poured 2 fingers of Johnny Walker over an ice cube. That would be the extent of his consumption for the week. As he cooked, he lost himself pleasantly in the task of trying to find flaws in a completed design for an improved accelerometer feedback circuit that he and Milton Weinblatt, his partner at Patapsco Engineering, had been working on for the past several weeks. 6 months earlier, Weinblatt and my grandfather had quit their jobs in the instrumentation division of the Glenn L. Martin Company to open their own shop. Jews, malcontents, and restless men, they were frustrated by the timid pace of iteration at Martin, and by having been passed over for promotion year after year, while Gentiles of lesser ability were made project managers and department heads. He and Weinblatt had sunk all their savings into their venture. The technology of inertial navigation systems, which enabled a rocket or missile to navigate and make course corrections on its own without external input or guidance, was in a fairly primitive state. Weinblatt and my grandfather were betting that the pace of innovation in computer circuit design, already rapid, was going to increase, soon making it possible to build non-mechanical, solid-state, or, as we would say now, digital navigation systems. If their bet turned out to be correct, Patapsco would be ready to take advantage of the innovations, and its proprietors would cash in. My grandfather felt in the soles of his feet that there were people climbing the front stoop of the house. The doorbell rang. It was a little early yet for trick-or-treaters, but he presumed that, as she had done every Halloween since her first as the Night Witch, my grandmother intended to answer the door in costume. He slid the wax beans into the boiling water and forbade himself to touch the steak until his internal timer had registered the passing of another 2 minutes. He was aware of a thread of anxiety pulling at his belly when he thought about this year's front stoop theatrics. But the truth was, this made him anxious every year. He was uncomfortable with the whole Crypt of Nevermore situation in general, the weird sexuality of the Night Witch, and of the stories she presented on the program, Blackwood, Le Fanu, Lovecraft. Freud would have a field day with the stuff. Reflected a little too closely the nature of my grandmother's sexuality as he experienced it, and, worse, the importance of that weirdness, that witchiness, to the hold that she had over him. The doorbell rang again. He heard a buzz of little voices from the stoop. He flipped the steak and turned down the flame. He went to the front door. The vacant living room troubled him unaccountably.
There was no reason for the living room not to be vacant, but it did not feel empty. The luminous dial grinned on the front of the big RCA console. Its automatic tone arm return did not always work properly, and he heard the stylus worrying the record label, scooch, scooch, scooch.
Record sleeves lay scattered across the top of the console. The record spinning on the RCA's platter was a 10-inch LP by Pipe Band of His Majesty's Scots Guard, 2nd Battalion, from an album called Marches, Strathspeys and Reels. Lately my grandmother had been in the grip of a mania for bagpipes. He did not even attempt to begin to understand it. He lifted the tone arm and switched off the console.
"Honey," he called up the stairs.
He had not seen my grandmother or my mother since walking in the door, but that was not unusual. Each of them seemed to spend increasingly longer periods alone, my mother in her bedroom, my grandmother in the room that my mother remembered as a studio, and my grandfather as a sewing room. When he was home, they would hang around whatever room he happened to be in, but when he was not around, they seemed to avoid each other. He opened the front door with a cast for an impromptu Peter Pan had assembled by chance. A pirate, an Indian princess, a fairy, and a little fellow in green whom my grandfather supposed was meant to be Robin Hood but made a serviceable Pan. The accidental Neverlanders offered to withhold from committing a ritually unspecified act of mischief in return for a bribe of candy. My grandfather was ill at ease with this custom, relatively novel in the early 1950s. In the South Philly of his childhood, Halloween was a night when masked Irish hooligans threw eggs and flower bombs and wrote obscenities and slurs and soap on people's windows. He looked for the bowl filled with loose pieces of Brock's autumn mix of candy pumpkins, corns, and cat's heads. That ought to have been placed by the front door. It was not there.
"Just a minute," my grandfather said to the trick-or-treaters.
He called again for my grandmother and my mother, but got no answer. Maybe they had gone to the store for candy at the last minute.
"Huh," he said. "I don't know what to tell you kids."
The children regarded him with careful and, in the case of the fairy, sharp expressions. My grandfather got the idea that his enactment of confusion struck them as insincere. He took his coin purse out of his pocket. He found 4 quarters inside it. In 1952, a quarter could buy 5 candy bars. The children went away content. Back in the kitchen, the steak was nearly done. He turned up the gas for another minute, gave it a poke with his finger, then slid it onto a plate. He returned the pan lacquered with amber drippings to the fire and glugged some Johnny Walker into the pan. There was a hiss and a billowing of vapor that stung his nostrils. He took out Alan Biles' lighter and ignited the vapor. As the whoosh of ignition faded to a simmer, he heard somebody scream. The sound arced like a skyrocket and burst with a yawp, almost a sob. My grandfather decided not to be alarmed. It had been an implausible scream, a Hollywood coloratura, somebody having fun of the season, one of the neighbors scaring the evening's foot traffic with a haunted house sound effects record album. He gave the bubbling reduction a couple of stirs to deglaze the pan. He listened. The scream was not repeated or followed by a creaking crypt door, a howling wolf, chains dragging across a dungeon floor. He poured the whiskey reduction over the steak on the plate, buttered the wax beans, and snatched the potatoes out of the oven with a mitt. Once again, there was no reply when he called out, this time adding the information that supper was ready. He had cut the steak into 3 pieces and buttered his baked potato when my mother, 2 months past her 10th birthday, walked in wearing old dungarees and a loden shirt with the tails untucked. He was a little surprised to see that she was not in her Halloween costume. Velvet brown, winner of the Grand National, in her jodhpurs and her gold and magenta silks. No doubt she had reckoned correctly that if she showed up at the table to run its steeplechase of sauces, condiments, and other hazards in the beautiful costume my grandmother had sewn for her, she would have been sent back to her room to change.
"Where's your mom?"
My mother glanced at the plate of bleeding steak between the two of them and looked away. Her features were arranged to give an effect of unconcern,
but it was easy to see she was upset about something. He recalled that she had planned to go to school as Velvet Brown for a parade around the neighborhood. He wondered if the costume had suffered some mischance. Maybe she had been teased. Behind the effort of her indifference, he sensed consternation. If the problem was the costume, her eyes said it had been spoiled. Her eyes said that it had been taken from her and torn to shreds.
"What happened?" he said.
She watched his hand and the fork it held convey her chunk of steak to her plate. She shook her head.
"Nothing."
"I thought you would have your costume on."
Tears rolled like beads along her eyelashes. They scattered when she blinked.
"Did something happen to it? Did you get it dirty?"
"Nothing happened. I changed my mind."
"What? You don't want to be National Velvet? Why?"
Her reply was rapid and muttered so as to render it unintelligible, but there was nothing unusual in that. Lately she did not really speak words to him so much as spirit them hastily and furtively out of her mouth like a bank robber tossing his gun and stocking mask out the window of a getaway car.
"Mumble, mumble, mumble," he said, as if quoting her.
"I said I'm not going trick-or-treating, okay?"
She was regarding the bleeding steak on her plate with unconcealed revulsion. She looked like she might be about to throw up.
"So I heard somebody scream about maybe 10 minutes ago," my grandfather said. "Now I'm wondering if that might have been you."
That morning, my grandmother had sent my mother off to school with an assurance that Velvet Brown would have her pie. Even as the promise was tendered, my mother could not help feeling that something dreadful lay coiled at its bottom. Her mother, she knew, had endured terrible things during the war and after. She had been taken from her family, and then her family had been taken from her. The Nazis had also killed the handsome and heroic young doctor who was my mother's real father, and who was usually played, in her imagination, by James Mason. Her mother had fought her way through the confusions and indignities of life as a refugee through homesickness, shock, mourning, professional struggle, and the storms of exaltation and fury that blew through her head with the inconstant rhythm of hurricanes. All this, while never losing the air of cheerful bitterness that, for my mother, defined bravery. When my grandmother promised my mother a Halloween horse, her tone had been terribly cheerful. She would allow that she was not wild about horses.
"I don't have to love them," she would tell my mother, "because you love them enough for both of us."
But my mother suspected that, in fact, my grandmother had a horror of them. If my grandmother was walking downtown and saw that a mounted policeman or an Araber with his horse-drawn fruit wagon lay in her path, she would cross to the other side of the street. When she could not avoid contact with horses, my grandmother would hold herself still the way people did when it hurt too much to move, and take breaths in small sips through her nostrils until the animal had passed her. If they happened to pass on a drive one of the many horse farms in the countryside around Baltimore, my grandmother would lower her voice or stop talking entirely, as if she thought the horses in the pasture might be listening. All day at school, my mother was in Mrs. Hump's fourth-grade class at Liberty Elementary. Though she tried not to think about it, her thoughts kept returning to the horse she had been promised, or rather to the dread that mysteriously was its passenger. It was like when you lost a tooth and your tongue kept finding and probing at the tang of blood in the gap. She knew from experience that, whatever its nature, the horse her mother constructed for her would manage to be both beautiful and disappointing. She hoped, though this seemed unlikely, that it would not also be strange. Parading with her classmates in her gaudy silks through the streets of Forest Park after lunch, Velvet Brown had felt an odd bereavement, an emptiness between her knees. She felt unhorsed. For this sense of loss, my mother blamed my grandfather, who had made the original promise to provide her with a pie for Halloween.
"I didn't even want a horse," my mother told my grandfather.
She was lying face down on her bed, having abandoned her supper, still in her dungarees and wool shirt.
"I was fine."
"I apologize," my grandfather said. "I thought that I would have the time."
Emboldened by his success with a set of carved and painted horses,
My grandfather had proposed to complete my mother's costume that year with a stick horse whose wooden head would be modeled on that of the horse from the movie version of National Velvet. From the start, the impulse was unduly freighted with guilt. Back at Martin, my grandfather's work had often cut into his time with my mother. But since going out on his own, he was almost never home. The theory behind the stick horse was that if my mother consulted on her horse's design and helped with its construction, my grandfather would no longer be neglecting her. Like many promises born of a guilty conscience, this one had fallen prey to the failing it was intended to rectify. The push to develop a closed-loop accelerometer meant that my grandfather rarely got home before 8, usually closer to 8:30, my mother's bedtime. In the last 2 weeks, as he and Weinblatt found their designs taking a promising tack, his work on the pie had all but come to a halt. "A stupid head on a stupid broomstick," my mother said. Her eyelashes were soaked with tears, and fury blotched her cheeks. Filaments of snot cobwebbed her face to the pillow. "Like I'm a baby. Like I would ever want my friends to see me with that." "I know." My grandfather was standing by the side of the bed looking down at her. "I'm sorry."
"You and your stupid idea."
"Enough."
"I was fine without a horse."
"Enough." My grandfather rarely raised or felt the need to raise his voice with my mother. As if to compensate for the erratic and unpredictable behavior of my mother had fashioned herself, by will and instinct, into the most tractable child in the city of Baltimore. She left off yelling at him and lay crooning into the crook of her arm. "What happened?" my grandfather said. "Where's your mother?"
"I don't know."
Now the poor girl just sounded tired. "She wasn't here when I got home. A record was playing. Her handbag was gone. I did my homework. I cleaned my room. I heard you come home. I wanted to see what she made. I went to look."
"And?"
My mother pressed her lips together. Her chin trembled. She shook her head and then buried her face in the pillow. She was not giving anything else away. My grandfather stood a moment, looking down at her. He wondered if the bigger misfortune was to have the crazy woman for a mother, or the father who was crazy enough to love her. He wanted to stroke my mother's hair or give her shoulder a pat, but he felt angry with her for throwing his failure in his face. His hands dangled at his sides like inoperable tools. He knew he was being selfish and unfair to a child whose only mistake had been to put her trust in him.
"I'll look into it," he said to the back of my mother's head. He wondered if he had ever said anything so useless.
My grandmother's domain was a room off my grandparents' bedroom that must have been a porch once. It was small and low-ceilinged, with a ribbon of mullioned windows running around three sides. My grandmother had found room in it for a sewing machine, a small work table, a floor lamp, and a dressmaker's dummy. To the left of the door as you came in, my grandfather had built some shelves for my grandmother's notions, her supplies, and her disorderly row of paperbacks, most with French titles. On the wall to the right of the door, over a steel typist's table, hung a bulletin board shingled with art postcards and photos clipped from magazines. Neither my mother nor my grandfather could provide me with much in the way of specific works or artists, apart from Van Gogh and a Delacroix tiger, but they remembered the imagery of the postcards and clippings as creepy, my mother, or typical, my grandfather. Still lifes of meat, coin-operated automatons that told fortunes, a family of musical dwarves who had survived Auschwitz. One morning the previous June, my grandmother had found a Luna moth expiring with languid wing beats on a tree in the backyard. That got stuck to the bulletin board, too, its viridescence fading with time to dull dollar green. The relative order or disorder of my grandmother's studio was as reliable a gauge as any of the tenor of her mind. There were others. Whether or not she greeted him by name when he walked in the door or called out a goodbye on her own departure. Whether she was in the middle of her cycle or a week before the end. If she brought him coffee in bed, that was a good sign. If she felt appreciated by the world. If there were cut flowers in the vases and jars. If the flowers were fresh, good signs. Empty vases were bad, and dead flowers worse.
If she touched her fingers to the back of his neck, as though noticing it for the first time, as though noticing him for the first time, that could be a good sign. If it was not February, if she did not get out her deck of fortune-telling cards and waste hours laying them out in crosses and grids, if she did not linger in the cave mouths of Catholic churches but only pass them by, if she was not lost for the 100th time in Vincent's letters to Theo or the Fioretti of St. Francis, if it was not a Sunday, Sundays were the worst. Every day had been a Sunday during the summer of 1952, days of lassitude, nights of insomnia, horrific dreams whose contents she refused to divulge, swallowing them whole on waking like a spy who feared capture. The sewing room filled with stacks of magazines she never got around to clipping, with sacks of grapes and cherries that rotted when she forgot to eat them and left the whole upstairs of the house smelling of vinegar. She would hang an old shawl across the doorway and stay in there for hours at a time. With a show of black humor, she would confess that she was in hiding, but would never say from what or whom, and did not really seem to be joking. She checked out the usual bunch of weird records from the Pratt Library. Indonesians banging on the local plumbing with hammers. G.I. Gurdjieff droning away at his harmonium. Those fucking bagpipes. And played them over and over on a portable record player. She rarely ate and never cooked. When she emerged from behind the shawl and went out, she became a magnet for proselytizers and truth possessors. Copies of The Watchtower and The Theosophist, tracts and pamphlets dense with references to soul travel and vril, replaced the sacks of rotting fruit. In late August, my grandmother covered the sewing room's window panes with squares of black paper so that she could not be observed by the shadowy wickering thing of which my grandfather then knew relatively little and understood less. The night before my mother started fourth grade, two policemen had brought my grandmother home, barefoot and wearing a man's fishing jacket. Somebody had seen her, partly unclothed and moving erratically down by the harbor, and thought she might be contemplating or risking suicide. Just as the police had arrived on the scene, she was seen to set fire to the pages of a book and throw it into the water. From the description supplied by the witness to police, my grandfather recognized the book as having been one of the marbled notebooks in which his wife's sketches of the latest Paris prêt-à-porter looks alternated with her notes, reflections, and dreams, jotted hastily in French, and reading, as far as my grandfather could tell, like hallucinatory telegrams. The cops thought about bringing her to Hopkins for observation. Once she'd set her notebook on fire and thrown it into the harbor, however, she no longer seemed distressed or unbalanced. She was cool, contrite, embarrassed by her behavior and state of undress, and lovely. One of the policemen recognized her from television. He loaned her the fisherman's jacket, and they brought her home. After that night, she had seemed distinctly sane and unburdened. She lost herself in mothering. She returned to my grandfather's bed and opened her legs to him with her accustomed readiness. She had tidied up her sewing room. Now, abruptly, it was a mess again. Three empty bags of Brock's Autumn Mix lay on the floor, slid open amid mounds and scatterings of vivid candy. The work table was strewn with her fortune-telling cards, the ones she had been given in the DP camp at Wittenau by the requisite old gypsy witch woman never seen again. Face up, face down, in a flat pile as if built into a tower and then knocked down. A snarl of brown fabric jammed the platen of the sewing machine. A full cup of tea with milk, the surface opalescent with congealed fat, an open bottle of aspirin, 3 inches of ash that had been a cigarette, preserved in the notch of an ashtray like fossilized proof that my grandmother had abandoned the job in haste. Incomplete on the floor in the center of the room amid the scattered candies lay the pie. At the moment it looked more like a kite than a horse. A strange coracle of brown oilcloth stretched over bent tomato steaks. An oval frame that curved upward at one end, partly covered in oilcloth skin. The green steaks slid into and were held in place by thin sleeves my grandmother had sewn into the fabric. They were lashed together at key junctures with wire ties. In its partial state, it took my grandfather a moment to understand. The oval of the body, the upcurving of the neck. It was something you might see in some old-fashioned mummer show, a pantomime horse to be worn around the hips. My grandfather had just formulated the thought, I wonder what she planned to do for the head, when he noticed the buck-toothed skull sitting on the typist's table under the bulletin board. A bone zeppelin, bleached, splintery as driftwood. Formerly the property of a small horse, or pony. Chapter 18.
It's really just the eyes, I said.
Mostly. My mother didn't say anything. She was looking down at the horse skull on my kitchen table. She pinched her chin between three fingers as if to keep from averting her face. I mean, that's all of it, obviously, but especially the eyes. The skull lay on the outspread towel in which it had spent the past 50 years, folded and stuffed into the old crow box under my mother's books and the painted wooden horses wrapped in newspaper. The towel must have been white once, but time and humidity had dyed it with streaks of brown and rust red. A broken nib of mildew had spattered it with black. In the sunlight coming through the kitchen window against the dingy towel, the unwrapped thing was radiant with strangeness. The incisors protruded to form a cruel beak, as if the skull had belonged to some monster bird of the Pleistocene. The jaws on either side, with their ridged molars, grinned like a pair of gaping zippers. The nose bone narrowed over the nasal cavity to a wicked prong. And into each orbit my grandmother had socketed a milfiore paperweight, multicolored cells honeycombed within a dome of clear glass. When I was a kid, the milfiore glass my grandmother kept around her apartment had always reminded me of bright handfuls of fancy hard candies. Cast in the unlikely role of eyeballs, however, the paperweights were like the kaleidoscopes of madness itself. "I can't believe she thought you would wear it," I said. "How is it ever supposed to attach to the neck?" "I don't know if it was."
"But you didn't make it for your costume?"
"That's what my father thought."
"But you didn't?"
"If you were making someone a horse costume out of sticks and fabric, is that how you would do the head?"
"No, maybe this was like how she saw it, her version, the Night Witch version." My mother was having none of it.
"The silks she sewed me were so pretty, perfect copies of the ones Elizabeth Taylor wears in the movie. They didn't have, I don't know, bat wings on them or anything."
"Yeah, no, I get it."
"They were beautiful. I love them. She knew how to make me a pie."
"So if it wasn't part of the costume, what was it for?"
"At the time, I think what I thought was that my mother, she had all these pamphlets and tracts lying around that she had collected. Religious tracts, Catholic prayer cards, but also things about Atlantis, Mayan religion, the, what is it, transmigration of souls, all kinds of nonsense like that. It felt to me like that thing," she pointed vaguely at the skull, "came out of all that religious mystical crap."
"You mean like it was almost kind of a, something she prayed to, an idol?"
"Not, I don't know, I mean, I was 10 years old, I guess I thought..."
"You thought she was worshipping a horse god?"
"I don't know if I went quite that far in my thinking."
"But now?"
"Now I don't think about it."
"Yeah, I know."
"You don't approve. You think I should just keep dredging it all up all the time?"
"Not all the time, just like every 10 years or so." My lame attempt to lighten the moment failed. She was looking at the skull straight on, and I saw that it was simply hateful to her. "Mom," I said, "forget it."
She made a Gallic noise of my grandmother's, for which there is no good onomatopoeia, so I suppose harumph will have to do.
If she were a woman of my generation, she might have said, "as if."
"I understand," I said.
"Oh? Okay." That sounded patronizing.
"You want to know what I think now?" She surprised me by grabbing the skull, swooping it off the table, and shoving it toward me, snout first. I jumped back, knocking over a kitchen chair.
It's possible that I may have screamed.
She wasn't worshipping the skinless horse with this thing. She was trying to ward it off.
Whoa, I said. Mom, I picked up the chair I had knocked over. You scared me.
Right, my mother said.
On the fir floor in the upstairs hall at the edge of the Chinese runner, my grandfather noticed a drop that looked like blood. It took the print of his finger and left a taste of salt on his tongue. In the doorway to the upstairs bathroom, a droplet had starred the wooden transition strip between fir and tile. In the bathroom across the grid of black and white tile, four asterisks pointed like the handle of the dipper to a blood arcturus in the space between the toilet and the bathtub. My grandfather's heart lurched. He turned to confront the bathtub. It appeared to be empty, clean and dry, but he forced himself to stare at it long and hard. He felt that if it contained my grandmother's body steeped in a tea of her lifeblood and Baltimore tap water, he could not trust his eyes to report, nor brain to comprehend the fact. Shock could be a kind of plate armor. He gave horror, pain, and loss all the time they needed to pierce it. But there was nothing. Only the shine on white porcelain and her flask of emerald bath oil, its note of benzoin, a lingering sting in the air. My grandfather went to the toilet and lifted the seat. On the underside of the left-handed branch of its U, at the tip, he found a comma, a little fish of blood. He folded some toilet paper, dipped the paper in the bowl, and wiped away the little fish. He ran some water on a washcloth and wiped away the stains on the floor. Then he stared down at the crossword puzzle tile, ruminating, only half aware that he was also taking a long-deferred piss. He considered clues and hints. He ransacked his store of experience of my grandmother and her behavior. He penciled in a few possibilities. One, my grandmother had been attacked, in or just outside the bathroom, and carried off by some intruder. She had suffered internal injuries or fought back and bloodied her assailant. In the absence of other physical evidence, this did not seem a likely scenario. Yet even after he had searched the house from cellar to attic, finding no sign of intrusion, he could not shake the feeling that there had been someone in the house. Two, my grandmother had injured herself, accidentally or on purpose. She was not accident-prone, but she had gone through periods during which she bit her cuticles or scratched her shins with her fingernails until she bled. On one occasion, she had plucked her eyebrows clean, and though this produced no blood, it had struck him at the time as a kind of self-injury, or better, self-vandalism. Three, she had been surprised by the onset of menstruation or by a flow that was unusually heavy. If she was menstruating, and in particular if more heavily than usual, this might have triggered some kind of psychological disturbance to explain both her absence from the house and the presence in her sewing room of a horse skull with paperweights for eyes. It had long been apparent to him, though at a level of consciousness too low for observation and plotting of data, that there was some kind of association between his wife's monthly cycle and the ebb and flow of her sanity. Following on this third possibility, he caught the flickering of a fourth at the horizon of his thoughts, but like a lightning strike it was gone by the time he looked its way. In the meantime, in some other part of his mind, his grandfather's pessimism and the brute force denial that he deployed in place of optimism contended over the question of whether he was making a mountain of a molehill here. Big deal, a few drops of blood. A hastily improvised and unhappily conceived horse costume, an absence that was not usual but hardly unheard of, especially when my grandmother had a show to do that night. He shook off this line of thinking and its appeal to his reptile brain optimism. Something was wrong, felt wrong. He had known it as soon as he'd seen the bagpipe records on the console. In general, my grandmother, in the grip of a mood, was inclined to hole up, shut down, or curl inward. But sometimes the woman would just bolt. Taking off that night when the police picked her up, ill-shod, ill-dressed, booking along the sidewalk with a forward cant and her arms held fixed at her sides,
conversing with invisibilities of pain, presenting like a classic urban nutcase, flying her nightwitch hair like the flag of madness. My grandfather went back into my mother's bedroom. She was sitting up, rocking back and forth at the edge of her bed, holding the carved horse that, working in the driveway one evening long after dark, he had inadvertently painted blue instead of black. He had been annoyed by the fuck-up. Naturally, that one turned out to be the favorite, the one on which she bestowed the power of flight. The girl was a labyrinth to him. Only by chance and error did he ever stumble blindly into her heart. Her face was puffy, and she wore a stoical expression. The rocking reminded him of the little girl he had met for the first time on a bench in the cold outside Ahava's Shalom. Defiantly serving out the inhumane term of a punishment she had imposed on herself, confusing obedience with rebellion and vindication with endurance. "Come," he told her, "put your costume on. We'll find your friends, and you'll go with them." My mother shook her head. "I have to go out," he said. He decided to lie to her. "Your mother's up at the studio. She forgot the book she's going to read tonight. I need to take it to her."
"I'll come with you."
You know, Pat'll be working the desk tonight. You know how he is about kids hanging around."
"I'll wait in the car."
"You don't want to go trick-or-treating?"
"No."
"Okay, listen, I'll tell you what. Your behavior recently, your manners, your schoolwork, I've been meaning to tell you. They've really been very good." He realized as he offered this praise that he had no idea if it was accurate. She had never been anything but compliant and well-mannered, however, and he assumed, though he had not paid much attention lately, that this remained the case. Her first quarter report card had boasted the usual cordillera of A's. "So," he said, "if you want to go with your friends because you've been such a good girl lately, how about we say, whatever you bring home, you can eat, no matter what. As much hazari as you can stand, all right? You can have it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. All of it. Until the whole bag is gone." Before the razor blade scares of the 1960s. Before industrial confectioners cottoned onto the market for small, individually wrapped pieces of brand-name candy, the loot a kid brought home from trick-or-treating was made by the lady of the house where it was given out. Popcorn balls, candy and caramel apples, cookies, marshmallow treats, toffees. Such items quickly went stale or lost their appeal, and after a week or two, whatever a kid had not managed to consume was ready to be thrown away. Since, as a firm rule, my mother was never permitted more than one treat per day, the bulk of what she collected on Halloween ended up in the garbage can. My grandfather's extravagant offer had no precedent. It was, transparently, a bribe.
"What's wrong with Mama?"
my mother said. Her voice deepened to a woeful contralto. "Nothing."
"I know it's something bad."
"Nothing is wrong. She forgot her book." My mother nodded as though reassured. She shuddered. My grandfather handed her a handkerchief. She wiped her eyes and blew her nose and handed it back to him. He put it, snot and all, into his pocket.
"I know you're lying to me," she said.
"Oh, is that right?"
"And I'm not going."
"No?"
"I don't want to. I hate candy apples anyway."
"So you'll trade with your friends. You like popcorn balls."
"It's bad for your teeth. Your saliva turns the sugar to acid. The acid dissolves the enamel, and you get a cavity, and have to get a filling, with a drill, and a bunch of shots in your mouth. I don't want that."
"So you'll brush." She held the blue horse up to her face at eye level and moved it through the air in arcs and dives. She half closed her eyes, a technique he remembered from his own childhood, making the horse and its flight more real through some enchantment of perspective and the lensing effect of lids and lashes.
"Look, honey, I have to go out, and I can't leave you here alone.
With all the people coming to the door, you don't know who's going to show up. All kinds of hooligans out causing trouble tonight. You remember last year they smashed every pumpkin on the block."
The blue horse dipped and banked through the air between them. She was finished with the conversation. Where other less tractable children might have openly rebelled or thrown a tantrum, my mother had learned to withdraw, to abstain,
to retreat from a scene of conflict without moving a muscle. My grandfather knew better than to waste any more breath trying to persuade her. When she checked out, there was nothing to be done but compel her.